registered.
Yeah, no, I said, you guys are on first. Thanks.
As chair of the Committee of Public Safety and Security, I'll call my committee to order. We do have quorum.
And I'll call to order the Committee of the Legislation, the Legislation Committee, for which we have a quorum with legislators Legowski, Ryan, Markham, and Meyer. And we're joined also by legislator Kessler. First of all, I want to thank the commissioner, deputy commissioner, and I don't know the third individual.
Lieutenant Donovan is the commanding officer of fiscal permit.
Hi, Lieutenant. Thank you for coming. And thank you for the to the county attorney's office for coming. And also want to welcome the president of the Westchester Firearms Association, Scott Salavia. I think that's all our guests today. Since I put this on the agenda, I want to start with just trying to put in perspective and provide some background for our meeting today and why we're here. And anybody is free to correct me if they believe I've stated anything inaccurately or you disagree with anything I say, whether it be about the law or the facts. On June 28th of this year, the United States Supreme Court, in a case styled McDonald v. City of Chicago, held that the right to bear arms in the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution was applicable to state and local governments. The court held that the Second Amendment was enforceable against state and local governments under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Specifically, what the Supreme Court said in McDonald was, quote, a provision of the Bill of Rights that protects a right that is fundamental from an American perspective applies equally to the federal government and the states. We therefore hold that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment incorporates the Second Amendment right recognized in Heller, unquote. Now, the issue of whether a right is incorporated in the 14th Amendment and applicable to the states is a very technical issue. But it's clear that on the basis of that decision, it's now settled that Westchester County must abide by the Second Amendment and the Supreme Court rulings regarding the scope of the right to bear arms afforded by the Second Amendment are binding upon Westchester County. Now, in another Supreme Court case, Heller v. District of Columbia, which was decided in 2008, the Supreme Court held that the Second Amendment, quote, guarantees the right of law-abiding, responsible citizens to use arms in defense of hearth and home, unquote. Just so everybody's clear, what the Second Amendment states is, quote, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, unquote. Now, what's the relevance of Heller, of the Heller case to Westchester? In my view, in Heller, the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional a District of Columbia law that banned handgun possession in the home and prohibited rendering any lawful firearm in the home operable for the purpose of immediate self-defense. Specifically, the Supreme Court invalidated the following provision of the District of Columbia law. Quote, each registrant shall keep any firearm in his possession, unloaded and disassembled, or bound by a trigger lock or similar device, unless such firearm is kept at his place of business or while being used for lawful recreational purposes. The relevance of the Heller decision is that Westchester County has a gun storage law that regulates how handguns may be possessed in the home. Section 527.21 of the Westchester County Code provides, quote, no person who owns or is custodian of a weapon shall store or otherwise leave such weapon out of his or her immediate possession or control without having first securely locked such weapon in an appropriate state storage depository or rendered it incapable of being fired by use of a safety locking device appropriate to that weapon, unquote. The similarity of the District of Columbia law to our Westchester law, I think, compels us to consider whether the Westchester County law is unconstitutional under the Heller and McDonald Supreme Court rulings. While we can wait for a judge to tell us one way or the other, I think we have an obligation to consider the validity of our law when the constitutionality of that law is called into question by a Supreme Court decision. So that's one of the topics we'd like to discuss at today's meeting. We are all deeply concerned about gun safety, and the Supreme Court stated in Heller that it was aware of the problem of handgun violence in this country and took seriously the concerns raised in briefs filed in that case that prohibition of handgun ownership is a solution. But the Supreme Court observed, quote, the enshrinement of constitutional rights necessarily takes certain policy choices off the table, unquote. And it is not the role of the court to, quote, pronounce the Second Amendment extinct, unquote. We are bound by the Supreme Court rulings and therefore must consider their impact on our county laws. But we should be clear that these decisions do not invalidate or hold unconstitutional gun control laws generally. For example, they do not invalidate licensing laws, laws aimed at preventing illegal possession and use of firearms, and laws prohibiting the use of unusual weapons like machine guns. The decisions in these cases afford constitutional protection to lawful ownership of firearms by responsible, law-abiding citizens. Another issue I think we need to discuss is the application of our gun storage law. It is not self-executing. In other words, how is it enforced? What authority do law enforcement officials have to enter the home of a citizen in lawful possession of one or more firearms to determine whether that citizen is complying with the law? We understand that inspections of homes take place based upon a letter from a licensing officer, a judge, requesting that the county police inspect the home to determine how licensed firearms are being stored. We understand but are not certain that these inspections are requested if a licensee seeks to add a fifth firearm to a license. This procedure, if it is indeed the procedure, does raise issues under the Heller and McDonald decisions, as well as the Fourth Amendment constitutional right against unreasonable search and seizures. So we need to examine and consider whether this procedure comports with the Constitution. The final topic on this issue is the application and licensing process utilized by Westchester County. The Westchester Firearm Owners Association has provided us with a memorandum raising concerns as to whether the application in use in Westchester and the licensing process comports with New York State law specifying the requirements for firearms contained in Section 400, firearms licenses contained in Section 400 of the penal law. We do understand that there's a provision of the penal law that an applicant show, quote, no good cause exists for the denial of a firearm license, unquote. And that's the subject of litigation challenging its constitutionality. But we have enough on our plate, and we're not getting into the issue of the constitutionality of any state laws. So that's kind of my views as to what we're here to discuss today. And I certainly look forward to being, we all look forward to hearing and being further enlightened by our speakers. And I just want to note we've been joined by Legislator Williams. Chairman Bogowski, if you'd like to.
Sure, thank you, Mr. Nona. Let me just say, as the chair of the Public Safety Security Committee, first I appreciate Chair Nona's recitation of sort of the current status of court decisions where we stand. I take maybe a slightly, my own perspective, let me just say briefly my own perspective on this. This legislature passed this law, our county law, I think before I got it, was probably 10, 12 years ago. Bill, I guess you were here, I think it was before I came back. So I take the position that when this legislature passed these laws and in the implementing regulations, that they were constitutional. As Chair Nona says, we now have a couple of new Supreme Court decisions. Looking at it, I think the language is certainly not the same. The D.C. law talked about banning or some other things. So I guess I looked at if we were passing the law today for the first time, we might pass the exact same law because it's, you know, reaching outside the confines of the Supreme Court decision. But certainly, as John pointed out, and there may be a case filed against us already, people would be looking at this, questioning the applicability, the constitutionality of it, and I think it's certainly relevant for us to also look at those. But I have, my bias is to sort of, this is the law we passed, let's understand it, let's go through it. But I'm less inclined to play judge on our own law. And if there is something constitutionally defective based on the Supreme Court decisions, maybe some judge will say that someday. But I point out, as far as I understand, until a judge rules on the Westchester County law, we have a constitutional, valid law that's on the books. So nothing that the Supreme Court did has invalidated anything that we have here in Westchester County, so that should be clear. But I just wanted to say that on the record that I'm
you know, when we pass a law around here, I like to think it's good in someone, unless someone tells us that our law is doesn't pass muster. So with that, thank you, John, for your comments. And
okay, we'll turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Lyusinski, I guess, or Commissioner Long, or Lieutenant Donovan, whoever. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming.
You know, with regard to the Supreme Court cases and the statute that exists in the county, we did not render an opinion as to what effect that will have on the statute itself. However, we did review the cases, and in recommending changes to the procedure for the pistol permits, in follow-up to a meeting with Mr. Somerville earlier this year, and a list of concerns we received from the Westchester County Firearms Owners Association, did make some changes to the process of applying for a pistol permit in Westchester. They are still in draft form, have not been fully adopted yet. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Lieutenant Donovan to just give you an overview of the concerns of the Firearms Owners Association and our responses there too.
Okay, thank you. We've been joined by Legislator Abinanti.
And also, let me just say, also a person who has a certain amount of responsibility in this area as well is the county clerk, Tim Idoni, and the county clerk has joined us. And he's here as well.
Thank you, Mr. Idoni, for joining us. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Lieutenant.
Well, basically, the as you know, the county police performs a background investigation on each applicant for a pistol license in this county. And as part of that process, we require the applicant to complete several forms which facilitate the completion of that investigation. That has been the process on a long-standing basis in Westchester County. We heard the concerns of the Firearms Owners Association, and we reviewed our internal investigative forms, and as a result of that review process, we struck a good number of questions from our investigative forms that we felt were basically duplicated information that was provided elsewhere in the application process, or where our questions had limited investigative value. So we heard the concerns of the group, and we modified our forms accordingly.
There's a whole bunch of forms I see included in the forms. And I understand under Section 400 of the penal law, the license is supposed to, the application form is supposed to be approved by the superintendent of police, the state police.
Well, the actual state application form is put out by the state police, and actually it's a fingerprint card that is completed in triplicate. The other forms are our own internal forms that we use to facilitate our background investigation.
Okay, the form I have, it's the state form, also goes through the questions that are, or the criteria that are listed in Section 400 of the penal law. Have you ever been terminated, discharged from any employment? Have you ever undergone treatment for alcoholism or drug abuse? And it goes through each of the criteria under Section 400. So, I mean, it looks to me like it asks for character references, it asks whether you've been indicted. So it looks to me like a little more than a fingerprint form.
It's, it's the fingerprint card. The applicant's fingerprints were taken on that card up until the point we went to digital live scan fingerprinting several months ago. Yes, there are questions on that form. That's correct.
Okay, then there's another form that says background investigation worksheet that the applicant, I take it, fills out.
That is our internal form. That's correct.
Now, is this part of the application process?
That is part of the application process. It's a form that we use to facilitate our background investigation.
But it hasn't been approved by the superintendent of police.
No, and I don't believe it's required to be with every state police. It's our internal form.
So, just so I understand, and there's a bunch of other forms that the applicant is asked to fill out as part of the licensing process. It's just, it's the position of the public safety department that those other parts of the application process do not have to be approved by the state police superintendent.
That's correct. But I will also add that those forms have also been accepted by the licensing officer of Westchester County. Those forms enable us to present a competent background investigation to the licensing officer. The licensing officer, I would say, endorsed our use of those forms over a period of time.
So, I'm seeing that, but so the state superintendent, the police hasn't approved them, but the judges have approved them? They've actually approved the forms?
Or? The judges have accepted our use of those forms. Those forms are presented to the judges in Westchester County with each application.
Mr. Nolan,
yes, sir. Yes.
Rather than if you were to go through the entire application as it presently exists, it might be better for you to hear the proposed changes first so that we
okay.
don't trust them twice as we go through.
Okay, thanks. And we'll open it up to other questions. I just want to get through this, understand what's part of the application process.
Well, as I said earlier, we received letter from the Firearms Owners Association.
Which I think is in everybody's packet.
And we adopted a number of the recommendations of that group. Specifically,
should we look at their letter? Is that the best way to go through this? Or it's up to you, Lieutenant.
Whatever. Do that also. I'll give you the bullet points, or we can go through the letter.
Give us whatever's easier for you. It's your
the Firearm Owners Association. Made a recommendation that the character references provided by each applicant not be restricted to Westchester County residents. We accepted that recommendation. The Firearms Owners Association made a recommendation that we not specifically prohibit a firearm from being stored inside a vehicle. Basically, our pistol license safety and information handbook contain language to the effect that a handgun could not be stored inside a vehicle. We accepted that recommendation. We understand that there may be instances where a handgun could be stored inside a vehicle. There could be situations, for example, where a person is traveling to a site, to a building that has some kind of a firearms restriction in place, and it may be impractical to do something other than to store the handgun inside the vehicle. We're taking the position now that it's a matter for the licensee to take care of. The licensee is responsible to provide security for his handgun. We won't specifically have a specific provision where we we say categorically a handgun can never be stored inside a vehicle. The Firearm Owners Association asked that a licensee under disability, such as a surrender order, or otherwise is given the licensee, a situation where a licensee is giving up rights to his handgun license, that licensee be allowed to surrender his handgun to a licensed dealer. We are adopting that provision. The association objected to the taking of photographs inside of the homes of licensees. We have accepted that recommendation. And I will say that when we perform these home inspections, it is on order of the licensing officer. I believe that was referenced earlier. Earlier today, when a fifth handgun is added to a license, most of the licensing officers require that public safety inspect the residence, inspect the method of storage. Okay, so we are still doing that, but we will no longer take photographs inside of the person's home. The group also asked that we relax some of the investigative questions that we presented with regard to, for example, obtaining a sport target shooting or a sport hunting firearm license. We have pulled back some of those questions and thus have shortened our forms. And the group asked that our investigative attachment for a full carry firearm license be made a part of the basic investigative package, and we have done that as well. That's the basic summary of the changes that we have made in our process.
If I could just add,
Commissioner.
There may be a draft that's inaccurate of the new packet. I had a brief conversation with Mr. Somervilla as we came in. He seemed to think that part of the regulations have been made more restrictive under the proposed changes that we have. That's not accurate. The only changes that are proposed to the process have just been articulated by Lieutenant Donovan, and the draft that's circulating around is not accurate.
Okay. So we'll get to see the draft as
absolutely
we move in. Maybe this process will help refine that draft. I'm going to open it up. Do you have anything else to add, Lieutenant, Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner?
No,
we'll open it up to questions for you from the legislators. I have some more questions, but rather than me dominating it, I know Legislator Harkin had a question.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question about the fifth handgun triggering the inspection. Could you just give us some background on how that came to be? Why is five the magic number, or beyond five? What's involved with that?
I can only say that it has been the longstanding policy of the licensing officers of Westchester County to require that this inspection take place when a fifth handgun is added to a person's license. It's been in place for many years, and I don't know how they originally came up with this five.
If I were to speculate, I would think it would be a safety and security issue of storing that many weapons at one time. We're looking to see if you have an adequate safe or containment device to hold that many weapons. You know, whether or not that conflicts with the recent Supreme Court case remains.
Right. I definitely get the point about the safe storage. I'm just wondering if there's like state statute that says five, or you know, why not six? Why not three? You know, that's all I'm trying to get at.
No, I think it comes from the licensing officer, how they arrived at the number five, for sure.
I just have a follow-up question on the procedure by which inspections occur. You heard my opening statement. I just have some. If the procedure is, in fact, a letter from a licensing officer, I have problems not only with respect to the Supreme Court decisions on the Second Amendment. I have questions about the 14th Amendment, the Fourth Amendment. And what we've been given, I think Lieutenant Donovan, you think you provided this to us, just a letter saying, from a judge saying, the individual named above has applied to the county court to review a permit to possess handguns. The applicant already possesses six handguns. Before issuing the requested permit, the court requires some assurances that the applicant has adequate, safe, and secure storage facilities for these weapons. That's not an order. It seems to be a letter. and I don't know where...
If I may, Mr. Miller, yeah. I think, you know, without rendering a legal opinion, I would
You're not here to pin anybody down on legal opinion.
As part of the, you know, as part of the process, I think that the judges are probably saying to you, you need to consent to this examination of the facility. You know, you're consenting to allow the inspection of the safe, which would remove the Fourth Amendment implication.
Is there a consent? Is there a written consent by an applicant?
I think written would be required, but, you know,
allowing... Is it oral? I mean, where's the... I don't see anything that indicates a consent by...
Well, I think if you're letting a police officer into your residence to view the storage facility, you're consenting
per se. So once the judge issues the letter and somebody shows up at your door and says, I'm here to inspect, and you tell them no, what are the chances are they're going to recommend giving you a license? I mean, you know, it's like...
Again, that's, you know, that's the licensing officer's addition to the process. It's really not within our purview to tell the judges what requirements they can put on the process. Someone certainly would have the right to challenge their decision should they not receive a pistol permit by refusing the inspection. But I think that's beyond the scope of what we're able to control.
So I understand. Your position is the licensing officer is telling you to do this, and you're going to do it. You feel you're bound to do it.
Yes.
So, okay. Just a
question. Let me just pursue that. Excuse me, point. We talked about five, but on the initial application or two permits, I mean, we have a law in the books now, safe storage. But I gather in terms of enforcing that on a day-to-day basis, it would be enforced either after the fact, after some event, you go in and do the investigation and discover there was or there wasn't a storage. That's one way of finding out. But up front, other than this number five and a judge, you know, the licensing officer, we really don't enforce this on the initial application, like someone has to say, I'm going to buy a storage box, I guess if it's the first one. Or number two or three. How do they? I mean, it goes back to your Fourth Amendment.
So, second, third, or fourth? There's no. Let me ask you this: it comes from the licensing officer. Have you ever gotten a judge, a licensing officer, asking or requiring, and it's quote some assurances, which is interesting. Some assurances. Is there any? Have you had that happen with, you know, one, two, three, or four? Any smaller, fewer number than five?
Not that I recall.
Yeah, so my question about
My feeling generally, you know, as a legislature, I guess I take the position we try not to pass a law that is, you know, almost unenforceable. And what we're hearing is today, it's really not enforceable until you get to number five, or sort of after the fact, if there was some incident, and then you can sort of, among the things you might be charged with, you didn't have, but it's found after the fact. So essentially, it's unenforceable up to a point. Which is just a whole separate issue. I don't know what we do with that.
Absolute triggering event.
Right, absolute triggering event. So it's an after the fact thing. It's interesting that it's not required up front. But let me. All right. But if I can just make sure I understand. Again, I guess we also know this. The existing system. Your department, the Department of Public Safety, is really charged with conducting these investigations. You're not even supposed to check it in. You make a recommendation, although I guess that may be something you're doing, but you make the investigation, give it to the licensing authority, and that judge makes the decision, yay or nay, on granting the permit. Is that correct?
Yeah, except that the policy of making a recommendation is longstanding. It goes back 50 years.
Well, I see some of the comments, I guess, from the association. I guess they're not happy, but there has been a longstanding history of making a recommendation to the licensing authority. Well, I don't necessarily want to get into that. I'm just trying to understand the process. You do make recommendations, whether you should or you shouldn't is up for discussion, I guess. But in terms of the legal requirements, you need to do the investigations. That's what you do. And that's for a new applicant. The county clerk's office, if someone wants to get an amendment for a second or a third, they go first to the county clerk's office. On an amendment?
Yes, they complete amendment forms of the county clerk, and we perform a briefer background investigation. We perform a name-based criminal background check and send the results to the licensing officer.
Try to bring the background record up to date without necessarily going through all those questions, at least if they have a criminal,
We don't go through all of the questions, but right. we we go through perhaps a briefer set of questions. If the person is looking to show an employment-related need for a gun now, and that's different from the earlier need, then we will receive that information, verify it, and send it to the licensing officer. Okay.
Well, and something you testified to before, I guess, just speaking personally.
Not under oath.
Right, this vehicle storage, just is my opinion. If I could see you gave a good example of it. But I would look at that as sort of extenuating circumstances, something may come up. I hope when you sort of draft the new language, you made it sound like because of those circumstances, you're just going to sort of take that out. I could see drafting something on extenuating circumstances, you could have it in the vehicle, but it's not sort of open-ended in the vehicle. See what I'm saying? Because otherwise, everybody may just go to the vehicle. It shouldn't. My own personal opinion, as opposed to carte blanche, they may be able to come up with, that was a good example, some extenuating circumstances. And under those circumstances, they're allowed to store in the car. But I, personally, I don't know if that, you should just open that up to they can just, at any time. But that's.
I think when we reviewed the extenuating circumstances, there were so many that it was hard to qualify.
I see.
And for instance would be if someone was going to go into a licensed establishment to drink alcohol and they're licensed to carry the gun, it might better serve the public policy or the public interest to have the vehicle with the gun secured in the trunk of the car.
That makes sense.
But as opposed to the home, is the car as opposed to the home? I guess that's what I was thinking of. If someone has the ability legally to store it in the car, they may forget the house, just keep in the car all the time, which may be good or bad, depending on...
Another circumstance that we bantered around when we were discussing this is if you have young children and you live in a small residence, perhaps the gun is safer in the car, secured in the vehicle, rather than in the residence.
Okay, I appreciate that. And let me come back to one of the reasons for this hearing. I haven't read the D.C. law, but our system seems to balance the investigations. A judge is involved as a licensing officer. I don't know if the D.C. law, has that type of... separation, if you will, but there's an investigation somewhere else. So again, in terms of trying to understand what's right, what's wrong with our law, we really have to go through the D.C. law line by line. Read at the court, what they interpret.
The gun storage law is there independently of any licensing law.
On the license itself.
A certain way.
Let's open up anybody. No, I'm fine. Anybody else? Mr. Avenatti.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As one of the authors of this law, we worked this out at the time with representatives of the gun-owning community. And I think we came up with a statute which meets everyone's needs. We all had the belief that guns are dangerous instrumentalities and that gun owners have to take the responsibility for making sure that the guns don't fall into the hands of people who would misuse them. And so we worked very carefully to come up with a statute which would accomplish that and at the same time not infringe on people's rights to own guns. As I look here, I note that we were very careful to not restrict storage to a place of residence. The statute does not say place of residence. It says safe storage. So the depository could be anywhere, as long as the gun is properly locked away, and only the gun owner can get to it. And then we were very careful to say that if someone negligently stores the weapon, wherever they store it, they're responsible for it, and that's a misdemeanor. So we gave the choice to the gun owners, but put them under penalty that if in fact they did it negligently, whether it was in fact taken by someone and misused, or just discovered to be negligent, that they would bear the penalty for that. So I would agree with your determination that it doesn't have to be in the house. The second point that I wanted to address was the question of whether this is an enforceable statute. I don't believe that inspection is a sine qua non for enforceability. We had said that this was an enforceable statute day one. Many of our laws say or mandate people to do things that we don't inspect every day. You don't have a police officer at every stop sign. There's an honor system, and if somebody violates it, sometimes they get caught, sometimes they don't. And it's the same thing here. if unfortunately an incident occurs that causes a police officer to enter a house or to go into a car and discovers a weapon that is not properly stored, then you have a violation of the statute. I don't think we ever intended for the police department to go in and to inspect every time someone got a gun license. The question of five or more raises a question in my mind of what's reasonable and what isn't. And we, at the time, I think, had some discussions about this, but decided not to deal with the issue because there were all kinds of other issues out there. There was a law enforcement imperative to ensure that people were able to safely store weapons. Also, there was some question raised once a person started to accumulate a whole series of weapons. And there was a law enforcement, viewpoint that we should have some understanding as to why someone is accumulating all of these weapons. I don't know at what point they become a gun dealer or a gun collector. I'm not familiar enough with the state and federal statutes, but I know we had some discussions about that. And there comes a point where there is a societal interest in saying, hey, wait a minute, we have a large cache of guns over there. Is this person capable of handling all those guns? Is this person on the up and up? Are they storing them safely? Or are they doing something that could be a problem for our community? And this wasn't just directed at kids taking guns. This was also directed at people who might be mentally unstable, become too old and become mentally unstable, or something happens in their lives. I mean, we see this all of the time. Barely a month goes by that somebody in the country is not fired who then reacts violently against the employer. I mean, we just had a situation in Connecticut. We had one in Greenberg several years ago at Curto's. So there is a societal interest in making sure that guns are not in the hands of those people who shouldn't have them. I always remember the one circumstance where we fought very hard to have renewable licenses because we wanted to make sure that when people aged or left town, that they took the guns with them. And there was a circumstance in Tarrytown where the county police failed to follow up on on someone moving. They went into Tarrytown and found that the gun owner who had not renewed the license moved to Florida, and they walked away and said, fine. And the next thing we knew, that gun was used in a homicide. So there is a societal interest here in having the police with some authority to look to see where these guns are being kept and how they're being kept. Why the judges came to five as that point, I don't know. But I don't know if the legislature wants to talk about that as to what the proper number would be. But somewhere in there, you want to make sure that the person that's got the guns is, in fact, mentally stable, doesn't have so many kids around that are going to be getting into them and they're probably storing them, and that they're not using them for wrongful reasons. And I understand the gun owner's concerns about this. They don't want cops coming into the house and looking around and asking unnecessary questions. But I think we do have it. We're not talking about toys here now. We are talking about dangerous weapons. And if the person has a valid reason for them and is doing what they should be doing, then they can have as many as they want. I'm just concerned about, it's much easier to be negligent if you can't fit that fifth gun in the gun box. And then you leave it in a desk drawer somewhere. On the other hand, if you are equipped to handle all of these, I mean, we had discussions about this. There were all kinds of ways. We didn't specify what the lock would be and what the device would be for safe storage of guns. So someone could have a specially designed closet that could hold 30 guns in there. But I think we have some interest in making sure that is in fact being done. And it's a balancing. It's a very difficult balancing question.
I appreciate the fact, Tom, that when this law was enacted, everybody believed it was was constitutional and it's correct and deliberated carefully. But I think the Heller decision and the McDonald decision changed the whole landscape. And your point about depository being anywhere, the Heller decision found it as a constitutional right to possess a gun in your home the way you want to possess it. It specifically states that it invalidated a prohibition against rendering any lawful firearm in the home operable for the purpose of immediate defense. So you were entitled to have a gun in your home for immediate defense. And I think our law raises an issue of whether you have to lock it up, removes the ability to keep it for immediate defense. And we're not talking about criminals. We're not talking about licensing procedures. Those cases do not prevent us from making sure that a licensed prospective licensee is mentally stable, hasn't violated the law, and checking on that. The issue in these cases is that the court found as a constitutional right to possess weapons in your home available for self-defense. Now, again, it doesn't allow you to have a machine gun or a cannon or a bazooka, but it does allow you to possess a handgun. So, you know, I appreciate what you thought when you enacted this law, but these decisions require a reexamination of that law in light of the fact that the Supreme Court held that this is a fundamental right under the Constitution applicable to state and local governments. I mean, that's what they hold. That's the law of the land. We're bound by it. You know?
May I respond? I don't believe that our statute in any way infringes the rights that the Supreme Court says individuals have.
Well, I suggest you read the Heller decision. Now,
we found...
Did you read the Heller decision?
I have looked at it, but I still believe that we can make it a crime to have negligent storage. And we are giving the gun owner the discretion to store it any way they want. We were aware at the time that there were new types of gun boxes where if you put your fingers in, it recognizes your fingerprints and pops open. There are various ways of storing guns so that they are secure and at the same time readily accessible. But we saw too many circumstances where kids, for example, were seriously injured or killed because of negligent storage. I mean, there was that famous case of two narcotics cops in the city of New York, husband and wife, sleeping. Each one kept a handgun in the desk, in the drawer of their night table. And in the middle of the night, the three-year-old came in to see mommy and daddy, both of whom, you would understand why they would keep guns like that if they are narcotics cops. They want to be able to reach them readily and quickly. And the kid came in, grabbed one of the guns, and the gun went off, and the kid was killed. So we saw too many of these circumstances.
Our law would not prevent that until after the fact.
Well,
our law would not prevent that.
It
would not prevent a situation like that happening.
If they followed our law and then locked them, then it would have prevented it.
This but we couldn't enforce it in advance.
Enforceability is different than inspection.
Enforceability is critical.
Well, but you're saying inspection is critical. That's where I think you run afoul of the Supreme Court if you require that everyone who has a gun in the county, because this doesn't apply just to handguns. This law applies to all guns, not just handguns. So if you're going to suggest that we need to inspect every home where there's a gun, I think you have a problem with the constitutionality of it.
Well, then you get a problem with whether you have a good reason that's constitutionally permissible to draw the line at three guns, four guns, five guns.
That's a separate constitutional issue. But we have lots of laws. We pass laws that say you have to have smoke detectors in the house. We don't inspect every house to see that there's a smoke detector. We believe that smoke detectors are important. They save lives. They wake people up when there's a fire starting so they can get out. But we don't inspect every house.
But when someone sells their house, the house is inspected.
Fine.
And you can determine whether the law is being complied with, and then the buyer can enforce it.
But that could be after the fact.
Anyway.
So we have the same circumstance here. When something else happens, that's when the inspection occurs.
John, if I can go back again, I guess the main reason for this meeting, Chairman Nono, so we wanted to explore these issues aimed at what's the relationship with our law, what's the status of our law, given the new Supreme Court decisions. But we can go around the table and give our legal opinions, yes or no. We either, one, should ask the county attorney, at least to get the perspective of our lawyer, so we don't really play lawyer, what they feel. But, I can just give some examples, because I led off this meeting by saying I'm not sure we really need to do anything. If we read the Hellerstein case the way I guess you're trying to read it, a gun, we can do nothing. A gun can be just out on the kitchen table. And one reading of the law is, it's inside the house, it's just out on the table, and that's legal. Or can we, as a county, step back? How far back can we go to say just out on the table, all by itself, we think that's against public policy for a variety of reasons. How restrictive can we get? And that's, can we get restrictive at all? And if we can, to what extent? That's some kind of new technology boxes. So I sort of tend to agree with Tom, but it's not for us really to be playing as the judge. If we are really concerned, as you said, we're concerned about looking at our law and should we make changes, I think we need to get, for starters, I guess, an opinion from our county attorney. And then as legislators, we can kind of read that opinion. Is there some fine line? Take the Hellerstein case. And if we wanted to say, where within the Supreme Court decision can we, do we have to make changes off the current law? Like that's what it comes
to. May I make one additional point? Nowhere in our statute does it say that the person can't possess it 24 hours a day. It says when it's out of their control. Well, that's all we're saying. If you want to keep the gun with you, so it's within your possession and control, while you're in the house or anywhere else, we're not saying you can't do that. What we're saying is you can't put it down somewhere where somebody else can easily access it, and take it away from you when you're not looking or whatever. You know, it's just, I mean, read the language. It's very careful.
So you're suggesting that our law would allow somebody, so it's fine under our law for someone to wear their gun to bed at night.
Sure.
They don't have to put it on a table. They have to actually wear it, like in a holster.
Well, but if there are no children in the house.
A jammy holster.
I mean, that's not.
If a person lives alone, there's nothing here that requires them to lock it away.
Well, there's nothing that requires them to lock it away, given whether they live alone or with 10 other people.
No, it's the circumstances that
control. But it's not in the law.
See, we've had this discussion. We had this discussion when we passed the law.
We had all these
no person who owns or is custody of a weapon shall store or otherwise leave the weapon out of his or her immediate possession or control without first having securely locked it. So that means if you leave the house, you can't leave it on the kitchen table. If you're the only one in the house and there's nobody else around and you want to leave it on the kitchen table while you're in the house, I think I could argue as a lawyer on behalf of that person saying, I left it in a location where I was the only one who could access it. The house was locked. There was nobody else here. And so when my kids came back from school, I took the gun, I put it in my holster, and we're fine. I think the circumstances dictate, and I believe that this statute would be found to be safe because we're not saying that somebody has to divest themselves of the weapon. We're saying as long as it's within your immediate possession or control, and it's not in somebody else's. Look at the negligent storage. It says where the weapon is accessible to another person who's not the owner. So that's, in effect, defining what we did at the top, and we intentionally did that because if it's accessible to another person, then you violated the law. If it's not accessible to another person, then you haven't violated the law.
Tom,
so as long as the gun owner is being responsible with the gun.
Law invalidated in Heller was one that said if someone has a firearm in their possession, it has to be disassembled or bound by a trigger lock. So what's the difference? How much difference?
In their possession or not in their possession?
In their possession.
Although we're saying while it's in your possession, you don't have to. As long as it's in the possession of the owner. And possession and control can be,
we
should be having
lawyers. We could discuss this all day, but Mr. Ryan,
we haven't heard this.
A long time ago, we worked on this, and as one of the people involved, that's right, we started working on it in 1999.
Yeah.
And I have to say, Scott Somerville is here with us today, and I can recall back to, he was very articulate in bringing originally to the table the issue that we all knew was there, that we had to respect and pay attention to, and that was the constitutional right to bear arms. But as the work was done on the legislation, Scott and members of his association were so very helpful in moving things forward in a way where we could finally arrive at a point where we had a very good piece of legislation that balanced the interests of all concerned, and we felt addressed the considerations and concerns that had been brought to the table by legislators as well as members of the public, and most prominently Scott and his organization. This is difficult. This is not an easy one because of the decision by the Supreme Court. I'm puzzled by it somewhat because I think that they certainly understand the concerns that the Westchester County Legislature and no doubt other legislative bodies across the country had when they put into place gun safety laws. And there was fierce recognition and insistence on the part of those who advance this legislation that we not do anything that would compromise the rights of individuals under the Constitution, recognizing that for a variety of different reasons, including the personal protection, the protection of the home, individuals had the right to possess that gun. There was also a need to balance it with responsible gun ownership. And I don't remember as a legislator being someone that knew this. I was in fact educated by the gun owners when they made us all aware of the fact that the large majority of gun owners, even without a law, already safely store their firearms, especially in a situation, as Tom was describing the different ones, a situation where there were young children perhaps in the household. And Tom's good point about perhaps even adults who could be counted on, unfortunately, to act like children with respect to things in the household, hazards, and the presence of a firearm. So, the firearm owners were very helpful in getting us to understand what the reality was out there. And the reality was that by and large, most already safely stored and secured their weapons in the home. So the work that was done was putting together a law for Westchester County that would take the good practices of the firearms owners, and together with the perceived need on the part of the legislators to do something and get it on the books of the county, these two things came together. We ended up with a statute that I think served as a model for legislation across the country. However, we now have this situation. I just find it hard to understand how the Supreme Court wasn't able to balance the two needs, the constitutional right with the need to make sure that beyond just perhaps a good practice on the part of an individual, if they cared to follow it, a practice where they would safely secure a weapon in the home when it wasn't in their possession or control and could be accessible by someone in the home who wasn't the owner, the custodian, and most importantly, if it was a child who wouldn't understand the danger of picking up a loaded gun that wasn't safely secured. So this is going to be a tough one, and I understand the points made by Mr. Nona. I certainly understand the position of Mr. Rogowski, and I too am glad that we were able to kick this discussion off in the way that we had, especially with the information that's been offered on some related topics by our departmental personnel.
Thanks, Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems to me that there are a couple issues. One is the constitutional issue that we've begun to discuss, and I think Legislator Rogowski's, Chair Rogowski's suggestion is a good one, that we get the county attorney to weigh in on this. So, one is the constitutional issue, and the other is the implementation issue. And I thank the commissioner and his team for working with the firearm owners to begin to refine that process. But what I guess what troubles me is kind of the history of tradition with the fifth handgun trigger. And I'm not saying it should be five or three or six, but we always strive to quantify things when we do legislation, and we want to have a rationale for why we've done them. We spent, and you would know this, Mr. Chair, we spent 2 years negotiating with DEC every word of septic legislation, and this is certainly far more pressing into public safety. And again, I applaud your efforts on this, but I think as we go through this process, Mr. Chair, I would like for us to spend a little more time on this part of the equation, the implementation side, to see if there is a need to codify some of these things in our legislation. so that you know, it's we're not relying just on tradition, but there is, you know, we know that there's a sound legal basis for all this, and it will protect the Department of Public Safety as it will the firearm owners. So right.
I mean, there's an issue of the facial aspect of the law versus how it's being applied. There are constitutional implications there too. Legislative test.
I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, not being on the committee, but interested in the issue. I agree with you, and I applaud you for bringing this up and questioning this law at this time, based on what has happened at the Supreme Court level. And I, you know, if you read that again, it says self-defense. It's pretty hard to have a gun for self-defense if there's a trigger lock on it and someone is coming into your home. They're not going to wait for you to unlock the trigger lock before you can use it for self-defense. So that in itself, I think, is enough to question this law. But my concern is this arbitrary, seemingly arbitrary fifth application or amendment to add a firearm to your license to trigger this inspection. What has there been any inspections where it was deemed to be inappropriate and that application was denied? Would that bring your other pistols into question as well? Has that happened?
I don't think it happened. I think if the investigator performing the inspection has had concerns regarding the storage, that the matter was probably settled by the discussion. You know, you should do more of this kind of thing.
You were advised how to apply.
Yes.
Okay, I just have a couple of questions on the licensing application process. You mentioned you're still reviewing it. And again, I have a question about the fact that our application is supposed to be approved by this superintendent of police, the superintendent of the state police, approved as to form. And I just picked out one. I don't know if this is still part of our application process, but there's something that says here, attachment sport hunting. And I assume that's an attachment to the application.
You use that form as part of our background investigation.
Right. Yes. So it's an attachment to the application, but I take it just take this form as an example. This hasn't been approved by the state superintendent,
no.
Please. And what criteria under Section 400 needs to be satisfied by asking someone, what is your interest in sport hunting with a firearm, and how often will you engage in sport hunting? What criteria under Section 400 does that inquiry address?
Well, it goes to whether there is proper cause for the issuance of a firearm license for that purpose.
See, that's what I have a hard time understanding. If someone says, I like to hunt, and I plan on hunting twice a year.
Then that's
how does that go to good cause?
Well, since they're looking for a hunting license, I think they're explaining their interest in hunting, if that's what they seek.
So if they say, we're going to hunt once a year, is that disqualify them? It's not good cause? If they say 10 times, does that change the analysis? I mean, I don't understand how that particular inquiry, how often will you engage in sport hunting, could possibly affect good cause.
The licensing officer would make the final decision after reading that information, and we will make a recommendation as well after reading what the person cites as his need. I don't think there's a magic number. I think the person is simply making his case for that class of firearm license.
I would just respectfully request that you consider whether an attachment to the application like this one that asks questions about sport hunting needs to be approved by the state superintendent because it's part of the application process. And number two, whether this has any relevance to good cause, asking someone what their interest is in hunting and how often they're going to hunt. I'm sorry, I don't see it, but please just consider that.
If they seek a hunting license, I think it's fairly self-evident that they would state their interest in hunting. Another example would be if they seek a firearm license for the purpose of employment, they will state their employment-related need for a gun. And we will verify that information and send it to the licensing officer for a final decision.
So if someone says, I like to hunt and I plan on hunting once a year, would that affect your recommendation at all? If they simply said, I like to hunt and I hunt once a year?
It's a case-by-case basis, basically, they make their case.
Any other questions?
Yeah, John, can I suggest that if you're in agreement, maybe send a memo to the county attorney?
Yeah, well, the county attorney can speak next, so you can ask him whatever you want.
Okay.
So, gentlemen, thank you very much. We appreciate this is interesting issue now that the Supreme Court has ruled.
And let me just say, for the members of the Public Safety Committee, we will be seeing the commissioner several times over the next month and a half. We have several issues we'll be working on.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you for coming. Good to see you again.
Mr. Meehan and company, would you like to...
And Chairman Nolan, let me point out the Environment and Energy Committee does have a 3 o'clock meeting, and it's a public works meeting at 4, so, I mean, I know we want to do what we need to do, but I think we'll just remember
it a little over, but not too much.
All right.
Voting for your discussion, so I don't need a big discussion. Okay, thank you, everybody. We have 4 representatives from the county attorney's office. I understand it's pending litigation, so, you could... say whatever you think you can say in light of the pending litigation, but we do know that there's a suit in the state Supreme Court challenging the gun storage.
Yes, there's 2 lawsuits that are pending. One is the state court, which challenges the county storage law, and then there's a federal court action, which really deals with the state law.
So the state court action, is that directly in response to the Supreme Court decision, basically saying, based on the Supreme Court decision,
that's what it claims. The county statute is unconstitutional based on 2 decisions. That we're defending that action, and not much else we can
do. So you don't really want to go beyond that, okay.
As far as the other topics that you've been talking about, the penal law issue is really a different issue,
right?
And the implementation is really a different issue, relates to state law.
Right. As far as the state, I know the other lawsuit challenges the constitutionality of that good cause requirement, and we're not, that's not our, that's
cap.
Beyond our pay grade. Maybe it'll be Mr. Evan on him someday, he left. But what about, one thing I think I would ask you to look at is this approval, the application approval requirement, and whether all of these attachments to the application need to be approved, and we should submit to them the state superintendent of police for approval, because it says the application has to be approved. And as far as I can see, this says applicant name, the applicant has to sign this before a notary, has to put in information. It seems to me you can't reasonably argue that these attachments aren't part of the application, but that's my opinion. I'd like you to look at that issue.
We can look at that and give advice to the Department of Public
Safety
regard.
Yeah, and give us advice too.
Okay, but again, remember that's the state law. So that there may be preemption issues.
All we're asking is this. This is the question. To be real, we're not saying is the state's law unconstitutional. Assume it's constitutional. It has all those requirements, including good cause. The state law requires that the application has to be in a form approved by the state superintendent of police. And the question is, as I understand it, the attachments that we have to the state form. All these attachments, one of which I asked about, the sport hunting one, whether these attachments should be deemed part of the application and should be submitted for approval. The commissioner, I believe the commissioner's office is saying, we don't think this needs to be submitted. And I would like you to address that question, whether all these attachments, a whole series of attachments.
You're not familiar with the package.
Okay, whether they need to be submitted for approval under the state law requirement. We're not challenging its constitutionality here. We're not questioning it. We're saying it's valid. It requires the application to be submitted for approval. So these attachments have to be submitted as part of the application.
I got your question.
That's it. Anything else you want to add?
No.
Okay. Next, Mr. Somavia from the Westchester Firearms.
Does any members have any questions? Thank you.
What's this? Is there a motion? Is there a motion to dismiss in the state case on at some point in time?
The motion dismiss returnable, I believe, October 1.
Okay.
And opposition to the motion is due September 17th.
Okay, just send us the papers.
I've sent you the motion.
Yes, I have. Yeah, no,
okay,
I do.
Okay, when we get the opposition, I'll scan it in. And
great,
it
thanks.
Okay.
Once again, Mr. Chairman, once again, gun owners always laugh at the least amount of time.
No, Mr. Oros. Where's Mr. Oros?
think that was done on some.
We wanted to give him the last word.
I do have a sheet that came out in 2007. And this is written by the Honorable Judge J. M. E. Murphy. And this is in question of the illegalities of the forms that the County of Westchester were implementing in their application process. This is a copy of it, which is signed by seven judges total that said that they were usurping, basically.
Leave a copy for Mr. Abinanti.
Yeah, and Ryan. We wouldn't want to miss Tom, yeah.
No, we got copies.
I got him. And there's so much has transpired since the start of our meeting here, and quite frankly, I don't know where to begin with some of it. We'll go over some of the storage law. If we want to stick with the state forms right now, they're absolutely illegal because they have not been approved by the state superintendent. The original forms have been. And that's what generically is to
that's
keep
this
concert.
Form? That's this form?
Correct. That is so that when, no matter where you apply within the state of New York, it's the same. It's supposed to be the same. The only counties, or if you want to say the city of New York, because of its populace, on bended knee years ago, went to the state legislative body and said, we have problems with guns. We have a real serious problem. We have special needs to be separate from the regular of the rest of the state. Therefore, that's where a lot of these decisions came down in the repetitiveness of being New York City, and they're courting New York City law with the denials on licenses and through appeals. And that's okay because they're allowed to do that. In the County of Westchester, once you hit Yonkers and on up, you have to deal with the state law. And sometimes some judges tend to forget that. Now, real curious thing.
Well, let's talk about this letter first.
Which one?
I just want, did everyone look at
the new one I got?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is basically taking the position that there's parts of the application that haven't been submitted for approval.
Right.
And what you were making.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, it's multiple layers, Mr. Chairman. Actually, with the state police and with that.
Seven judges have signed on to this.
Correct.
Oh, the judges said they haven't approved it. I see.
Now,
since 2007, then since this letter.
And no, they did nothing.
So that's three plus years.
They had a complete heads up that they were doing things illegally and absolutely nothing changed underneath.
They left.
Yeah, whether you want to call it the old administration, wherever some of those people have not changed, they're still there prior. This was the original handbook. Mine actually had less pages when I applied years ago.
Okay.
What you got now, and you're all welcome, actually, if you'd like to pass that around, that's an original. Basically, the old file, this old copy, because I was told the one I did receive wasn't correct. This is the new book. These are the papers that they're saying that are additional, containing those three, which are 37 pages. Plus, you have the new booklet, which includes, unless they're going to change it, underneath this one is 32, 34 pages worth. In respect of my Florida license application, is a copy of mine. One page, fingerprints. State of Connecticut, identical. The same background check through the FBI, NICS, mental hygiene, all that's being done with the same one. Questionnaires that they have there, and if you've read some of those pieces, have you ever seen, as a character witness, someone drink? Have you ever drunk in excess? I'm sure somebody in their life has. They're very misleading, and they're using them against.
Here.
Using it against in an act of denial with them. And as far as the storage law, no, I don't like the people coming in the house to say any kind of storage, because it sets up for two things, and we fought this at the beginning, and I was in contact with both Legislator Ryan, and yeah, I know you weren't here, Mr. Gowski, but and Tom Abinanti. There's economic segregation. So what you're having is, they're coming in and saying whether or not you have a good storage facility. So who's to judge what storage facility? That was the argument from day one. Who's to judge that? So someone who's is impoverished is losing the right because they've got such a high standard that they couldn't apply to it and couldn't get a license and losing a right. And that was a big thing. So economic segregation throws on a fixed income where the lower job couldn't store, and those who were more affluent that could keep up with the stores because just because of money.
Scott Mitchell is asking, is it because it's the cost of the bond? I mean, the storage was so it's literally...
There wasn't supposed to be a regulation of what it is, and what you've got is you wrote a law,
so to require,
and your officers, again, usurping that authority by saying coming up with their own. If you read into that application, it's alarms, it has a bunch of things and criteria to have to meet that clearly the law doesn't indicate. It's up to the gun owner to how they're going to store it. And quite frankly, what we're hearing...
What's your economic segregation? If the box costs, $125, you're saying someone may not be able to afford it, that's your... I mean, I'm just
right. The bottom line, then, Mr. Abernathy and I, when that thing was formulated in our conversation with a lot of people, was if they could afford a closet with a separate lock on it, that's what they could afford. And other people brought into the case that you have to have a lock safe. If you remember, the original one was a trigger lock on the gun in a safe. And some couldn't afford it all. And the whole idea was you just couldn't do that. That's why that's unlabeled on that. And again, you've got your police officers now usurping that authority of what you wrote and coming up with their own guidelines. And that's, we're really against that. The immediate control thing we felt was almost too tight. We had an argument. Tom and I came to some things you let go, he wouldn't budge, and that's his politics. As you know, I've been here for quite a long time. And we had an agreement with that, with some other things, and that's the way it went down. And that's been fine. And this is unconstitutional now only because of Heller. Besides that, if you feel it is, that's a whole other position. The application for a license has got to change too because of the decision in Chicago. They're basically saying, and even in Heller, is that he wants it for defense of himself. And they expanded it in Chicago that says you have to have the Second Amendment, which means that any time that you feel that you want to possess the firearm for self-defense, it's of you, your family, and home. And the way they've gone on these restrictions are mocking what happens in New York City. And we're not New York City. We're Westchester. It has to abide by the state. It's either carry for... There was a possession in a home or premise, and that's it. All these other things aren't. If you really want to get into it, if you're camping, they're refusing. If you're taking outdoor photographs, that doesn't qualify. So you're getting refused. There's a whole section of people, and I can attest to this because I've got papers in hand. I'm close on time for 3:00. They've got what we call a bench or a desk decision. What is a desk decision? The applicant never got to the judge. Police told them they couldn't do it. They think that the police are the authority, and they're clearly not.
From employment? Is there a basis?
Yeah, well, there was the employment. You know, there's another thing. How come you're supposed to give up all your financials? I mean, you really don't do that maybe to the IRS unless you're investigated. Why does money have to do with a carry? So, today you carry $10,000 or you do it. So does that tell me that you, Mr. Rogowski, are a highly qualified life or more? Or does at some point you're considered better than everybody else to be able to carry it, to defend yourself? Or at some point does the money become so elevated that you're really not there to defend yourself, but to guard the money, which is inherently now is more valuable than human life? I don't understand that. If it's about somebody who doesn't deserve a firearm because of some doubts in their background, then they don't deserve it. Then they don't get it. It's either up or down. You either do or you don't. The mental hygiene thing, and Tom and I spoke on it at great length. Absolutely agree with it. Background checks, absolutely agree with that. And things change during the day. As far as the storage again, when a new family starts off, they store one way. When you have children, you store another way. When you're single, you can store another way. Those changes in someone's life happen. And you have to have the latitude to store accordingly the way you see fit. That's where Heller came into that. You can't be mandated to do something that... When I had children, I stored one way. I basically stored the same way, always out of reach. But there's different places in the house that you could get to. That's all. I know them. Nobody else knows them. I'm locking my house. Anybody who breaches a locked house is not an authorized person. I understand, Tom, with the children, we always talked about that. That's why people store differently when they have children than when you do when you're single. And how you store it is up to the gun owner. The problem that I've seen, and we've discussed this in the past, is that the county is now assuming liability on doing your inspections. Because if something goes wrong, the lawsuit Now it comes back to you because now you've approved it. Same with the renewable license, that you're opening yourself up for suit if something should go up. Something's happened, you got to know that was skated. Doesn't mean the next time you will. The more that you mandate and we abide, if something goes wrong, the deeper pockets in a lawsuit provide, and the county's liable.
Scott, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
One of the other things that I thought we talked about, though, it's not just kids and people who were invitees into the house. We also wanted to make it more difficult for criminals to break into a locked house when you're out of the house. You don't want people to just leave it around sitting on the mantelpiece. You want to make it as difficult as possible for criminals as well. We don't want more guns in circulation. I mean, there's enough of them out there. You can buy them in all kinds of places.
I'm in agreement with what you're saying with anyone who gets in that to try to prevent that. But again, it's difficult to mandate the laws after the fact. This child endangerment laws, all the rest of the laws in the books are still already on there. None of that comes away. You know.
Well, I do think.
Don't forget the renewable license that you wanted, and when you're doing that, you're doing your backgrounds on those.
Right.
So your mental hygiene is to show up.
No, it's not just that. It's if you have, let's say, you have five guns, okay, and you take one with you, and now you leave four.
Right.
And you go away for the weekend.
Right.
And somebody breaks into your house. If you have them just easily stored under the bed or in a box or even in a closet, you know, those are four guns that are now on the street that somebody's selling. On the other hand, if you had a safe, we had discussed this, people using safes and stuff like that, it's less likely. Now, look, some people can break into anything, I understand. You know, but on the other hand, it's less likely that those four guns are going to be out on the street.
Well, we talked about that. Again, those who could afford it. That's what we came down to. Those who could afford all those things and some that can't. And now it's a guaranteed right. Before, it was some people actually doubted it. It's a guaranteed right.
But there are, you and I had discussed this. We were going to try to get the prisoners at the jail to make gun boxes.
We did. We went over that.
So we have inexpensive gun boxes. And we tried that, and we just couldn't get the administration to do it. Maybe we can try with this administration. They're more interested in getting people working. Maybe we, you know, prisons
and stuff
like that.
It was a good idea.
The question I have is interesting that Tom raises. You might be able to have a valid requirement to store guns in a lockbox if you're away, because then you don't need them for your immediate self-defense.
Right.
Interesting. I mean,
yes.
I'm not sure Heller deals with that particular issue. If you're not home.
I think that once it's really out of your control, I think it becomes a factual issue for a trial as to whether the person was in control and possession of the weapon or not. I mean, if you're sitting down at the TV and you get up to go get a soda or something, and you leave the gun next to where you were sitting, and then you come back to it, you know, 30 seconds or 2 minutes later, the question becomes, was it still within your possession and control? I mean, some of us could argue it's not.
You want to make a decision one way or the other. You don't want to leave it open for every specific fact situation you could possibly imagine.
Well, because you can't. You can't write a statute that covers all the circumstances.
The problem was we're trying to split hairs. What is immediate control?
Right.
That's where we always said as gun owners is what the problem is, because we're the one would be at the fault with that. And prior to the law, or if you lock your house, is to prevent burglars. It's at some point, it can't be the gun owner's fault. If they've done the best to their ability, either dismantle the guns, which we've talked about, which really never totally made it into the law, or
that's what the District of Columbia law in Heller said. It has to be rendered inoperable.
Right. It's
validated.
That's in our statute.
You can't do that.
That's in our statute.
That's in our statute. Rendered inoperable. That's what.
That's one of the alternatives.
Well, that's what they said was unconstitutional in Heller.
Right.
They said that's the deal.
You can't do that. The problem is, if somebody's breaking in your house, you can't go through in the middle of the night trying to put the gun back together again. That's inherently when only accidents happen. Loading and unloading.
I understand, but this is not requiring you to do that. But that's one of the options to comply with the law, if I remember correctly. Where is it? I don't know, it says in the definitions, it says operable shall mean in relation to a weapon. The weapon is able when loaded to be fired or discharged. So where is the part that said? Because I thought that what we had said was one of the ways of complying with the law was you render it inoperable. You can do that with a gun lock. I assume you could take it apart.
Now, on a quick note.
So if you're leaving for the weekend, you have a choice. You lock it, you take it with you, or you take it apart. It doesn't affect money. Money doesn't, a guy with a lot of money might have a fancy safe, but a guy who doesn't,
just take, is there a firing pin in these things? I mean, can you take the firing pin
out? Some people are technically not savvy or armored to do such things. Other guns are easier, depending upon each. There's so many out there.
Tom, can
we have the time to discuss?
Can I suggest Scott is a veteran of these discussions. These discussions. Right. Let me suggest this. I don't know how long it's going to be, 1 month or 6 months or 9 months for the court to decide if at some point in the future we may, in fact, have to revisit our law and make some changes. I think certainly at that point your input will be very helpful, and we'll have a give and take on how within the confines of Heller, with the law, assuming our law is knocked out, what, if anything, can we do to pass along Westchester? I'd like to defer to that time.
In the meantime, we'll work on getting cheap gun boxes for everybody.
Yeah. The application process right now, whether that comes out or not, is wrong. It's illegal.
Well, that's something
They don't have authority to do it.
Public safety working with you to improve the safety?
I had our meeting in March.
Sounds like they said the draft was a little delayed.
So
right. So why don't we see when the change? They say the change will be coming out shortly, and then certainly the public safety committee.
Public safety. How come many states have one form? 38 states have all got licensing one form. It goes to the same FBI, same national check. Fills out one form. You do your prints now it's electronic, and you get your license. There's a license, and instead of having an inventory,
to sum up the application process, which we kind of didn't discuss so much when I mentioned it, I have to say I'm concerned by the position of the Department of Public Safety that there's a state form that's approved, and we can, here in Westchester, tack on attachments to that form that people have to fill out and sign. But it's not part of the application, and we don't have to submit it for approval. I'm very troubled by that.
And that goes to Scott's point about New York City.
I'm also troubled by, on the gun storage law, whether or not on its face it's constitutional or not, this ad hoc, you know, well, if it's five guns and the judge sends a letter, it's not even an order, it's a letter that says, I think it's advisable that you look. And sure,
we appreciate your cooperation.
They say, well, you consented to the search. Well, if some police officer shows up at your door and says, look, if you're going to get an amendment to your license, you better let us come in and inspect your house. I'm not going to say no.
I've got facts from members.
I'm troubled by that.
I wouldn't worry about the fact that it's a letter.
Without a revocation hearing. Without anything.
But where's the authority?
No, that's the issue. The issue is not the form of how they requested it. The issue is what the authority
is. It's a letter.
What the judge is saying there is that one of the factors that he or she is considering is the evidence of proper storage. In determining whether or not to issue the license.
Okay, let me say this. Melanie,
basically you haven't given me enough information, cops. I want more information.
See, based on Scott's prior conversations with the administration, once we see these new requirements, I think it might be appropriate for us to meet again and bring it back.
I'm not sure, Mr. Co-Chair, that they'll be looking for my approval prior to going to print.
No, they probably won't be. I assume they're going to come out with them at that point.
As a gun owner, I will tell you, membership and the boys and girls feel abused all the time downstairs, and I mean that genuinely, abused. I'm in this right now as an advocate is because I got abused. I was denied. It was clear cut. It goes into prejudices, and that's why I'm here.
We appreciate you coming.
Fight it out where others don't, and that there's a lot of people who don't. They just don't. They're afraid. They're intimidated.
And what's troubling is seven judges have signed the letter indicating the application process is on.
And what's changed, Mr. Chairman?
That's 3 years ago, and I haven't seen anything where they changed their mind. So I think we have to follow up on the issue of the licensing process and on how the gun storage law is implemented. And I understand that, I personally have the view that the gun storage law does violate Heller. But I understand that we're probably not going to repeal it. We probably should await the outcome of the court decision. My personal opinion is irrelevant to whether it's
never relevant.
It's my personal opinion. Just want to make that clear. I'm not speaking for the committee, the county, or anybody else. But we need to follow up on the application process and on this loosey-goosey, in my view, way in which the inspections take place.
Quick note, I've also got copies in here, when we have time, of applicants who refuse on either employment and target.
Can you send us those? We'll make copies and we'll distribute.
Send them to Marty.
Okay. Yeah, we'll distribute.
I'm sure we will have you back.
Thanks.
So thank you very much for coming.
Thanks.
To the Committee of Public Safety, we have 1 7 minutes.
So moved.
June 21st. Moved by Mr. Harcum.
Second.
Second by Legislator Meyer.
Wait.
This is June 21st, Public Safety.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think everybody knows
we're going
to find Ryan. Scott, good to see you. And I move 2 sets of minutes for legislation.
Wait. I'll second. Public safety.
Vote aye.
Okay. This is June 21st. I pass public safety.
Right. Okay. 2 sets of minutes moved by Mr. Harcum for legislation.
Marty.
Is there a second?
All in favor?
Marty.
Aye. Motion to adjourn.
Marty, hold on 1 second.
Motion public safety to adjourn.
So moved.
Second. Mr. Ryan.
Thanks, John.
Who moved the legislation? I'll move legislation.
We are adjourned.
Second. All in favor? Aye.
E&E, don't go away. We're going right into session.
We're adjourned.
You can go to your office.
I'm going to the bathroom.
Just go to the bathroom. John, will you stick around?
Yeah.
For E&E?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Peter, just give us 5 minutes to take a breath.